song. Our title, as we've said, is that faith in God is logical, and could have also said, you know, the logic of faith or reasons to believe in the existence of God. And I want to start with two simple syllogisms, right? We have a number of, 25-cent words for those that like to collect those. Syllogism is a three-part or collection of three statements that lead to a conclusion. We have a major premise and then a middle or minor premise and the conclusion. And they build, and of course it's a conclusion that we're after, usually when people use syllogisms. Now, they can be used to discover truth, and they can be used to prove truth. And of course, there can be faulty syllogisms, right? So we want to examine them. So here's our first syllogism. That which begins to exist must have a cause. Straightforward. Second, the universe began to exist. So our conclusion is the universe had a cause. Now we're going to examine these statements subsequently, but we'll just lay out the groundwork here. All right? So that which begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. The conclusion is the universe had a cause. Our second syllogism is that the universe had a cause. Endless recursion or regression is logically impossible. Therefore, our conclusion is the cause of the universe must be uncaused. All right, so that's fairly straightforward. And then by extension, we would say that uncaused cause must be eternally self-existing. We could develop a syllogism on that. So what we have done with those two syllogisms is deduced or logically demonstrated that for existence, as we know it, to be, there must be a cause that is eternally self-existing. We call that cause God. But let's unpack and expand that. Let's examine these propositions carefully and in sufficient detail. First, that which begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist. We can look at that first one momentarily. The universe begins to exist, or that which begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist. All right, but let's look at it. An eternally existing, uncaused cause is necessary, both literally and logically, for something to begin to exist. Now, the problem with logical language and these formal structures is that we can get lost in them, because we don't usually speak like that in everyday life. So let's walk through it slowly, a bit of repetition, while some of us are less accustomed to this kind of discourse, all right? But for something to begin to exist, we say, well, no, you know, a guy who's only been alive 50 years can cause something to begin to exist. As a furniture maker, I could make a chair. But that is just the latest result in a long chain of caused events. Right? So this chair that, you know, I make in a day, well, that's not really a day for me, but, you know, a chair that I, as a chair maker, could make would not be me, a finite being, a caused cause, making a chair. It would be one event in a long string of events that must have an ultimate cause, a start point. All right, so I hope that part's clear. Nod if this is making sense to you. Your eyes aren't glazing over, you had too much supper, and now, you know, you're starting to nod off. Is that good? We all know some are a bit iffy. For anything to begin to exist, it is a logical and literal necessity that we have an eternally existing, uncaused cause. We'll come back to that and try and discern the nature of that uncaused cause. Now the universe began to exist. Everybody believes that today. In fact, physicists would say that's proved. Whether you accept Big Bang theory or not, everybody believes that the universe had a beginning. It wasn't always so. But the Big Bang theory is one evidence thereof. Another proof or evidence thereof is that the universe will have an end. This is something that cosmologists and physicists are certain of as well, that one of the laws of thermodynamics, you know, entropy, everything is degenerating and heading to a state of disorder. The universe as we know it is destined to have an end. And something cannot be eternally existing if it has an end. I mentioned the fact that we all believe that the universe began to exist today because that wasn't always the case, and we'll touch on that in a bit. The universe is expected to end. It's demonstrated by all known laws of physics. That's something the Bible recognized 3,000 years ago in Psalm 102, ascribing creation to the Creator. The psalmist said that you're going to fold them up and put them away. They're going to wear out like a garment. You're going to be put away, you know, or cast off or discarded. And predicting or identifying that concept. But that's not our point this evening. Motion, motion, even circular, cyclical motion, must have a beginning. Physicists know. What do I mean by that? All right. And some of us may or may not be aware of these things. Physicists want to say that the universe has been spontaneously creating itself and then ending and creating itself and then ending eternally. Well, that's like a sine wave or something, or a circle, something moving in a circular motion. A sine wave is one way of expressing circular motion. But again, it had to have had something bring it into being in the first place. It had to have a cause. And what these theorems do is they simply create a situation of endless regression, which is a logical impossibility. We're going to look at these and some specific examples as we go on. Even theory of evolution, that contrary to a literal interpretation of the Genesis account in the Bible or other accounts, the theory of evolution poses that human life is a result of millions of years of biological change and evolution. And the theists and the Christian theists' response to that is that, well, yeah, God used that mechanism to create human life. Well, that's one theist response. Other Christians assert a literal 6,000-year-old earth, a literal six-day creation. I don't hope to try and sort that out this evening. The point is that even if you have millions and billions of years, you still have a beginning. And that beginning of necessity depends on an eternal, uncaused cause. That's the point. Even one of the more recent hypotheses, I think it's recent, is of panspermia. It's another 25-cent word for your collection, that alien life forms have been seeding the universe with life, and that we are a DNA farm for aliens who have figured out space and time travel and can move all over the place. And so humans weren't created by God, but by aliens seeding the world. This is a theory that some espouse, and even no less a biological luminary than Richard Dawkins has given a nod to that this is an interesting idea. He didn't say he believes it. But even if that were the case, there still needs to be a beginning for those aliens that we've never seen or encountered. And it's fascinating to me that people will believe in the existence of aliens and deny the existence of angels, even though there are more witnesses and testimonies of people encountering angelic beings than alien beings. But we'll leave that discussion. So regardless of how we view it, whether from a relatively young creationist viewpoint or a very, very infinitely old or almost infinitely old developmental point, for us to exist, it is necessary that there exists an uncaused cause that is eternal. And that's demonstrated by logical reasoning. Some might argue, well, that's not proof, and we didn't claim that this would be proof, but we want to point out, because we live in an age where the notion that believing in God is, we live in an age where the notion exists that to believe in God, you can't be logical or rational or so on, and that you just have to have blind faith. Not at all. Faith is based on evidence. And we'll touch on that, if not this evening, on another occasion. There's a necessity to faith, but it's not blind faith. Nowhere in the gospel are people asked to just believe something on say-so without evidence. That would be preposterous. Let's look at the other proposition, that endless recursion, or one facet of it, endless recursion is impossible. You know, people have, and typically secular scientists have mocked. And by the way, I hope not to mock or deride anybody, whatever their viewpoint is in this. I hope to conduct my life and discourse and discussion with an approach of we're all human beings making our way through what is often a very difficult existence. And let's try and help one another. Even when our ideas clash, let's try and clash those ideas with a view to helping someone see a very helpful truth and free themselves from a very harmful belief. Let us not approach one another as adversaries. But secularists have noted a long-standing Eastern belief rooted in mythology of the earth being supported by elephants that are supported on the back of a giant turtle. And they've extrapolated, well, what's holding up the turtle and so on. And turtles, infinitely, endless regression. And that's impossible. And I would agree, but I would also point to what we've already demonstrated, that evolution and panspermia and endlessly being created and being destroyed universe is the same thing. It's endless regression, and it's not possible. The universe not cyclically creating and then ending and recreating itself. I noted that Stephen Hawking, a great physicist, for many, many years believed that God created the universe, but he, you know, used physical laws to do it. I read that. And he pointed out the fact that it appears that the entire universe has been carefully designed to sustain life on Earth. I believe in later years he abandoned that to suggest that the law of gravity makes creator unnecessary, and gravity means that it was inevitable that the universe would create itself out of nothing. Yes, I see puzzled faces, because that's just logically incomprehensible. Robert Dicke, I think in 1961, postulated what he called the anthropic principle, which was similar, that all of the laws of physics seem to align to produce human life, not just life on Earth. It's interesting that this notion of Mr. Hawking relied on a species of string theory known as M-theory, and requires the invention of a whole new mathematics to try and prove it. I don't know where they're at today. But, friends, so much of this theorizing is based on a determined effort to devise a solid explanation for the existence of the universe without recourse to a creator. right? People are expending, if you want to put this in street jargon, or, well, not street, you know, gutter, but in everyday speech. People are trying to prove that there isn't a God, and that and they would believe that if we can come up with a way that all of this exists without God, that that would be sufficient. But that is poor logic as well. Many skeptics of religion base their worldview on incredulity, right? Just don't believe it. And they have a visceral or an emotional reaction to a revulsion from what they believe to be unreasonable demands of religion or unsavory behavior of religious people. It's like, I just don't believe that. They look at the religious texts or religious claims, and not with a careful examination, but kind of like what you see on the news level of examination, and they're revulsed. Or they will survey religious texts and not consider the context and proper application, and some moral impulse is revulsed. Aristotle, Democritus, Epicurus, and Lucretius believed the universe to be eternal. Remember I said earlier it wasn't always that way. These were philosophers. And they decried the immorality of the Grecian gods. Epicurus wanted to believe in free will, and he concocted a theory of atomic randomness that made free will possible. But what the other philosophers recognized is that without a creator, man had no free will. That has problems. It has implications. That's something to look at. Now, if it's true, it's true that man has no free will. But it should, at least, the implications of that should give us pause and make us examine it and make sure. Epicurus wanted to believe in free will, and so he came up with this notion of atomic randomness. But he believed, at least what I have read of his writings, I never knew him personally, obviously. These are all before Christ, Greek philosophers. He believed that vice, what we call sin as Christians, and fear of damnation or punishment from the gods were the most destructive psychological forces. Right? He's referring to the Greek gods. He was not a monotheist. Some would say that Epicurus was a closet atheist. That seems reasonable. But he detached. He postulated that the gods never had anything to do with the affairs of man. Lucretius took it a step further, he came after Epicurus, and he wrote his treatise on the nature of the universe. Everything is just naturally occurring. And Epicurus wanted people to be free from the notion that they would be punished for their sins, or punished by the gods for not pleasing the gods. And he also wanted them to live free from vice, although there is not a morally compelling reason to abstain from vice other than it's not good for you without divine lawgiver. But this was his plan. And so he sought to make the gods irrelevant. And so you have the riddle of Epicurus, which is not logically compelling. And in the interest of time, we may pass over it. Maybe we take 60 or 90 seconds. The riddle of Epicurus, if I remember it correctly, is simply this, that evil exists. And if God were all-powerful, evil would not exist. Sorry. If God were all-powerful and all-benevolent, evil would not exist. So for evil to exist, God either is all-benevolent but not all-powerful, he can't stop it, or all-powerful, he can stop it, but not all-good, because he won't stop evil. But that is predicated on the assumption that all evil, aka pain and suffering, is bad. That there is no good effect from pain and suffering. And that is by no means a certain proposition. So the logic or the riddle of Epicurus is not substantial. It relies on us assuming that pain or suffering or hardship does not or cannot produce good, and it is it is an evil thing to allow it. But there we have some of these great minds of old, and they decided that the universe was eternal. They could observe naturally occurring laws, and that was their proof. Subsequent minds have demonstrated to everyone's satisfaction that it's impossible for the universe to be eternally existing. And so we're still confronted with this logically compelling, what in science I think they call the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis is that there is an eternally self-existing creator to the material world. And people, as we noted just a moment ago, they have this determined effort to try and find a reason or a way to explain existence that doesn't rely on the existence of God. Aldous Huxley, descendant of the famous physicist and cosmologist Thomas Huxley, who engaged in the debates between religion and Darwinism at its inception. Aldous Huxley was some descendant down, and we would perhaps know him most famously for his book Brave New World. But he wrote another much less well-known book called Ends and Means, wherein he talks about politics and philosophy and so on. You know, does the end justify the means kind of a concept? Ends and means. And here are some quotes from it taken in context. Breaking in, he said, "I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning." Perhaps I should define meaninglessness, a world without meaning. Here, a world without meaning is a synonym. It's another term for a world that is not created by a creator. In other words, the notion there is that everything is just the result of unintelligent forces or non-intelligent forces, that physical forces have created everything that is. There is no grand divine purpose to life. It's just matter in motion. And the implications of that are simple and clear and unavoidable. There is no moral authority by which you can impose any belief or behavior on any human being and press upon them divine retribution or punishment for violating that. He says, everything now is a matter of opinion. Meaninglessness. Life is just matter and molecules in motion. That is what the term means. So with looking at that, we can better understand his statement. I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. Consequently, assumed that it had none and was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. This is a man in print telling you, bearing his soul, what drove him. He goes on in that same portion, those one or two or three pages. Those who detect no meaning in the world generally do so because for one reason or another, it suits them. It suits their books, which means them, not their writing. They're not all writers. It suits them, it suits their books, that the world should be meaningless. It's more convenient for me for the world to not have a meaning, a grand purpose. Therefore, I don't see any of it. The Marquis de Sade was a philosopher, and he was infamous for very filthy and degenerate writings. Anyway, we don't want to get into him, and I have not studied him in detail, and I've read none of those writings, I assure you. But from him we get the word sadism. That should tell you all you need to know. You can see a little bit of his philosophy in Huxley's book, Brave New World, but we'll leave that aside. Huxley writes that de Sade's philosophy, remember, the father of sadism, was the philosophy of meaninglessness carried to its logical conclusion. The Marquis de Sade, in his philosophical writings, justified from a universe that created itself and has no meaning, that it is therefore rational to do whatever you want, whether they are perverted things or cruel things. And he was correct. It's logically consistent. The philosopher David, I think, Hume, posited that it is equally rational if one wants to stop the itch on one's finger to either scratch it or annihilate the world. Because both achieve the desired end, which is to stop the itch. The choice one makes is based on one's value system, but not on any rationally compelling purpose. Huxley goes on, the philosopher who finds no meaning in the world, and this is key, is not concerned with a problem in pure metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. And friends, this is where not your individual neighbor atheist is at particularly, but the champions of it, the what people call atheist fundamentalists of today. Even Sir Richard Dawkins, I believe, and I hope I'm not maligning him, helped to fund an advertisement campaign in the United Kingdom where posters were put up on bus stops. There's probably no God, so just enjoy your life. Do what you want because you will never be held accountable for it once you die. That is whatever, however moral, however well-meaning the purveyors of meaninglessness are, that is an unavoidable logical conclusion of it. Now, we recoil at the idea of meaninglessness at an emotional level, and I want to look at that as well. And at an intuitive level. What do we mean? Well, a meaningless universe is such that a snake eating a frog is no different from a tree falling in the forest, from a murderer killing a child, from a shooting star falling in the sky, a meteor. They are all simply physical phenomena that are inevitable as a result of the origin of the universe. That's what meaningless means. Nothing is of any significance. A rock, a landslide. These are the implications, and we are kept busy with all sorts of things in life, lesser things, to distract ourselves from this fact. If there is not a creator of the universe, if the universe is self-creating and everything is a result of inexorable, that is unstoppable, inevitable, physical laws, nothing matters. It might matter to you, but you don't matter. It is fascinating to watch scientists who are incensed at religion and argue that it is a moral evil to be destroyed, at the same time argue that we are simply the accident of a universe that created itself without cause, and at the same time argue that there is no such thing as free will. And I have observed this spectacle and just blink. I suppose they should pity the religious person and realize that this is an inexorable result of the Big Bang, that there would be such people who, this is just atoms in motion, matter in motion. It's fascinating. But our reaction to the idea that your life, or more importantly, the death of your loved one is no more significant than a leaf falling from the tree in autumn, everything in most decent and normal people is revulsed by that notion. But if that is the case for us, we should not then try and avoid the fact that it is either true, what's true, the death of my loved one is no more significant, and all my emotions and sadness thereof and all of those things, none of that has any inherent significance, any more than a leaf falling or a shooting star, any other physical phenomenon. It's all just matter in motion and completely without any inherent value, significance. It's all just subjective. Somehow, in almost every human being, there are people who are unusual, there are people who are deranged, and one should usually avoid saying everybody, except that we'll all die. I think that's fairly straightforward and uncontroversial. But if I can use it in the general sense and not strictly literal sense, everybody rejects the idea that it's meaningless. Everybody rejects the idea that to mutilate a human being, to massacre, murder, the atrocities that are committed in the world are really of no intrinsic value. Nobody believes that. Nobody lives like that. Nobody sits there, oh, I am just having an irrational, emotional response to this person being murdered and dismembered in front of me, and really this is just as insignificant as a sunset or a rock slide, and I'm going to carry on my merry way. Nobody lives like that, except maybe a psychopath or a politician, forgive me, some disordered person. Nobody lives like that. We believe instinctively, and here we touch on another 25-cent word, epistemology. Right, the science or theory of knowledge and how things can be known. And in our world today, it usually is relegated or pushed into intellect. You can only know things through intellect and science. But I would argue that we have four common ways of knowing things. Intellect, emotion, intuition, and sensation. And that they are all valid. They have their limits. Each of them have their limits. Each of them can be wrong, including intellect. And they should all work together. Sensation is the most obvious one. A little child, don't touch that. It's hot. Sensation teaches a child that is going to be unpleasant. They learn hot and cold. Sensory perception. It is a valid means of knowing something. Intellect. We've relied on our intellect in these syllogisms. It's a valid means of knowing something. We can think wrong. And we can experience or feel things that are incorrect. Emotion. I would argue that if you don't have an emotion of compassion, when you are walking by, let's say a little child, a helpless little child, in a puddle or a pond, and it's going to drown, and you aren't moved primarily by an emotion of compassion to want to help that child, there's something wrong with you. This is a way of knowing the right thing to do in a circumstance. It can be wrong. We can have all sorts of wrong emotions, and haven't we all suffered from that, whether our own wrong emotions or someone else's? And intuition. Intuition is almost like, you know, quantum mechanics of knowledge. We just, bonk, arrive at the right answer, bypassing thought, feeling, we just know something. That can be wrong as well, but it can be right. And there are myriads of examples of that. And I submit that those four common and basic ways of knowing things are valid. And that they're that visceral, that revulsion to the idea that nothing in life matters, a murder, a rape, any cruel, indecent act, that none of it matters, that none of it's any different from a leaf falling or a rock or something. That our rejection of that idea, and it's universally the case, is a valid witness that that idea is false. We're looking at the logic of belief in God. And our summary conclusion thus far is our syllogisms and other considerations lead us to a creator. The religious skeptic and sarcastic critic, Voltaire, said, my belief in God, and he was a deist, he didn't have any holy text that he ascribed to, said, my belief in God is a result of pure reason, not a whit of faith. He was a deist. He believed in the existence of a creator. And from there, some would go and say, as a colleague of mine did recently, that he believes, as Abraham Lincoln did, that God created the universe and then went off to do other things. I would submit that that is highly improbable. And so from logic, the logic of deism, there exists a creator, we want to move to probability. Right? Logic and probability are not identical, but both are reasonable. Logic is that, you know, if 2 times 3 equals 6, and half of 12 equals 6, then 2 times 3 equals half of 12. It's logic, right? But reason, more generally, is not as certain. But probability is very reasonable, and we live most of our lives based on choosing the most probable thing to be true, and we're usually correct. Just think about that. I make the assertion, or rather the observation, that almost everybody, I'm going to say everybody, but remember I mean almost, everybody lives their life based on the making a choice as to what is the most probable. And most of the time, they are correct. Think about. I'll give you an example. All right? It is possible that every time I drive my car off my premises, I could be killed by a drunk driver. Do you all agree that's possible? In fact, we all have heard of someone in our community that was killed by a drunk driver at 7 o'clock in the morning while he was driving on his way to work, leaving a widow and I believe 4 children. Happened in the past couple of years, I believe. It is possible, and I am aware, I don't think about it every time, but I am aware that every time I drive my car off my premises, it is possible I could be killed by a drunk driver, by someone falling asleep, by someone that becomes deranged, by a truck tire coming off, and that used to be all in the news decades ago. It's possible, but I conclude it is the least probable outcome. And so far, every single time, I've been correct. And anyone that drives a motor car makes that same calculation, consciously or unconsciously. You're assuming that the most probable outcome is that you will not be killed when you go driving. Am I right? This is how we all live. And so I make this case that probabilistic arguments are reasonable, and we all do it, and it works. So in light of our syllogisms, that there must exist an eternal, uncaused cause for the material world, I submit it is most probable that a cause that would produce beings such as you and I, that have will, that have volition, intelligence, and a host of other faculties, would possess will and intelligence. That this uncaused cause is not just randomly producing things without any thought, as much as we can define thought, or choice in the matter. At a theoretical abstract level, I suppose that's possible, but it is the least probable. It is more probable. If we think of any work, some of you know I make furniture and design it, but in the world of art and architecture and craft, it is commonly observed that you can know a lot about the artist, the creator, by what he produces. And so I conclude reasonably that the most probable case is that this uncaused, eternally self-existing cause, this creator of the universe, has intelligence and volition to produce this. And the apparent design, with an olive branch to my atheist combatants or adversaries, apparent design, the amazing recurrence of the Fibonacci series or the golden mean proportion throughout nature, from huge galaxies and nebula down to shells on the seashore, to the human form, and everywhere you find it, the mathematics and the pattern and the recurrence of it, It's most probable that this creator is intelligent. I would submit that a being that would create intentionally and intelligently beings that also create and are very interested in what they create would himself, and I use that in a grammatical sense, not wanting to impose a masculinity, although I believe that from a biblical point of view, but for the sake of our discussion, just from a grammatically correct point of view. It is most reasonable that a being that would create creators would himself be interested in his creation, as most creatures that create are. I submit that it is most probable that a being that would make creatures that are so highly communicative would himself be a communicator. And therefore, this intelligent, volitional creator would be interested in and communicate with these conscious, intelligent beings that he has created. I submit that reason would lead us to conclude that this is the most probable state of the universe. Incidentally, these attributes are ascribed to the Creator in the sacred texts, and it is this Creator that Jesus came to reveal. And it makes sense that logically, we would conclude God exists, and reasonably, we would conclude that God is intelligent, purposeful, aware, and communicative. And that our response would, at the very least, be a very strong curiosity and desire to know and to communicate with this Creator. I'll give one or two more probabilities or conclusions. Given the duration of human history, I think, based on these other probabilities, that it is most probable that this Creator has already attempted and made communications with his creation. It behooves us then to consider the various communications and however preserved that purport to be communication from the Creator and examine them to see if they are worthy of merit. And in so doing, and maybe I'm getting ahead, in so doing I have found without challenge, without question, the claims of Jesus Christ to be the most credible of all that is available to us. That this intelligent Creator is also concerned, as we have concern, with help us, and has devised a way whereby we can be rescued from the wrongs, both that we have committed and that have been committed against us. And that was the whole message of Jesus. That's for another time. I close with the invitation that we find in the Old Testament, Psalm 34. It's an appeal to the skeptic. Earlier, at the start, I quoted the prophet Isaiah, "Come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord." Here I quote the psalmist David, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him." Very far from demanding a blind faith in himself, the invitation of God to human beings is to try. Come. Like, taste. Have a see. You'll find it's very good. And that, I submit, is the invitation of God to all of us this evening. Are there any questions as we enter our question portion of our evening? Any questions from the floor?
What would you say then, talking to the Islamic saying, how can you prove a man who created God?
So the question is, who created God? And I thought, and I thank you for raising that. When I was a teacher, I'd always say, if you make a question, you're probably speaking on behalf of other people who have the same question but don't ask it. I would submit that the logical syllogisms address that, that this cause must be uncaused, eternally self-existing. Well, how can that be? That's another question. But it's logically the only, that's the choice we're kettled into, that God is eternal and self-existing. That's the conclusion of the Bible and perhaps several other religious texts. No. No, because eternally self-existing means he didn't emerge from nothing. He always existed. What's that?
He just was.
Always is, yes. And in fact, that's how he's presented in the Bible. I am. No, we argue the point that everything that begins to exist has a creator, right? And we have identified that everything we know to be in existence materially had a beginning. Therefore, that relies upon a being, a cause outside of time, which had a beginning, outside of the material universe, that could cause that. That's what we call God, and all of the attributes that are implied in that are what we find attributed to God in the Bible. I have a question here written. Is there proof that God exists? Not just good reasons, but incontrovertible proof. How's that for a question? And my first thought to that is, no, I don't think so. You might look aghast at me. Well, don't you have faith? Of course I do. But that's not the question. The question is there proof, absolute bulletproof? And really, our acceptance or our notions of proof are subjective. Right? Subjective. I'll give you an example. And this is philosophy 101, which, forgive me, I think it's a bit ridiculous, but it is a philosophical question. It's an elementary philosophical question. If you go into a room and it has only one access point, and that's the point through which you go in, and there is a chair in that room, and you see the chair, you sit on the chair, you touch the chair, and then you leave the room and you close that access point and stand attentively guarding that access point, is the chair still in the room? And how do you know? That's the question. Well, my response to that is, you ask any simple person, they'll say, of course the question, of course the chair's in the room. How do you know? You just know. It's obvious. Now, that would fail you as an answer in a philosophy course, but it is actually the right answer. I'm sure some philosopher would groan to hear me say that. The point is, how can you prove that chair's, and that's a fairly simple one. How are you going to prove it so that your philosophical interlocutor, there's another 25-cent word, your person giving you the gears, my friend at the back likes to do sometimes, how are you going to satisfy him? How do you know? He's always coming back behind, and he's going to press you. So this idea of proof is extremely difficult. And some would say, of course there's proof, and you know, and they point to a million things. I would submit that that's not proof, that is evidence. Reasonable evidence. The court of law, I think, is beyond evidence, beyond reasonable doubt. I'm not sure you could even make that case, but I would submit that there is strong, reasonable, good evidence to not only believe in the existence of God, but a personal creator that can be known and that communicated himself to humanity in the person of Jesus Christ. I would believe and think and hope to demonstrate in the oncoming weeks that that is what the strongest evidence is. And this is where faith comes in as a response. So I'd be interested to hear someone say there is absolute proof that God exists when you consider the definition of proof. Perhaps that's a surprising response from you know, Christian pastor, please. But I hope you understand what I've said there. There's evidence, I believe, the clearest and best evidence. But ultimately, if there was the kind of proof that is commonly demanded today, there would be no need for faith. We're going to look at, in subsequent talks, the need for the usefulness of faith, the necessity of faith. So follow this thought experiment with me, and we've got a few minutes left for our time. Follow this thought experiment, whereby if we put, let's say over every major city in the world, but let's pick on Toronto, and let's suspend or have hovering over the city of Toronto, let's say 1,000 feet up above, you know, above the CN Tower, so I guess, you know, however tall that is, this huge 1,000-foot-tall, flaming, terrifying-looking angel with, you know, real science fiction powers that has a flaming sword, and every time somebody committed a crime, pointed his flaming sword at them, and this just lightning bolt come out and incinerated that person. Boom, gone. Do you agree with me that it would not take very long for all crime in the city of Toronto to cease? Do you agree? Because there would be proof that if you broke the law, you were toast in the most literal expression of that word. That'd be proof. Bang, that happens in real time. But how much of that crime would only stop out of fear of retribution and not purity of heart? So that would be proof. And I submit that if there was that kind of proof for the existence of God, the world would be quite different. But many hearts would be wishing that God didn't exist, just as many of them wish that today. They wish that, as Aldous Huxley so transparently set forth, because if I get God out of my life, then I'm not accountable really to anybody, you know, short of, as long as I don't get caught by some, you know, person with more power than me. I can do whatever I want. And that, I'm not saying everybody's like that, but that is a thing. So I'm not convinced that proof of God's existence is either necessary or even good. Be interesting to hear thoughts respond to that. How are we for time? A couple minutes. How does this prove Christianity? Which religion is correct? Stay tuned. We're going to look at those questions, and they're good and reasonable questions. But we started with the proposition that faith in God is logical. And that's where we are. We've demonstrated that, I trust, with the syllogisms. I would then posit that it is probable that this Creator is willing to help, wants to be known, and is at least as smart as you and me. I used to say that to students who were trying to give me some absurd story, you know, just, and I'd shut it down and say, look, just assume I'm at least as smart as you, all right? Yeah. Would you believe that? That would end it, you know, okay. Busted, so to speak. It's reasonable. And so faith in God is a trust. A trust that this Creator is fair-minded and has goodwill. This was the announcement at the birth of Jesus. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men. And so if I choose good things, if I pursue the knowledge of this Creator, he's got enough power and influence to create this universe and would most reasonably be expected to be interested in, then I can reasonably expect some response, some guidance, some help to know him and to do what is right. I believe that we have demonstrated this evening that that is the most reasonable course, or a most reasonable course of thinking. I would further entreat the listeners tonight to consider that to neglect the pursuit of the knowledge of a Creator is an insufficiently
deep. It's a we should do better. We should not be so distracted with lesser things. It's an insult to the Creator, really, and it's shallow of us to neglect the most important questions of life for lesser pursuits. And so I'd entreat us all to pursue this Creator and get to know the one who made us. And I trust we will discover, if we taste and see, that the Lord is good, has wonderful things in store for those that love truth, love what is good, and will get to know Him. Let's bow our heads and close in prayer. God in heaven, we thank You for the opportunity to consider together these things. For the health, relative, comparative well-being, strength, all of the things that are bestowed upon us, not distributed equally throughout the world, but sufficient for each of us to reach out and respond to an amazing being who's created an amazing universe and has been merciful to each of us. We commend one another to Your blessing and keeping care, and ask that we might be helpful to each other in the pursuit of the knowledge of God. Amen. Right. Well, that will end our discussion this evening, but you're all welcome to visit and explore further. God bless. With that, we'll be dismissed.